Hi, Mike Ladd with you now for Summer Features on RN. Today we have part three for you of Vikram Seth's novel in verse, The Golden Gate. Here's a quick recap. John was introduced to Liz via the personal ad columns in the San Francisco Bay Guardian. His ad was placed against his wishes by his ex-girlfriend, the artist Janet. Despite this, Liz and John have fallen in love. Phil and John were colleagues in the electronics business until Phil resigned and joined the peace movement. Phil met Ed, Liz's brother, at a party, and has begun a relationship with him. Meanwhile, conflict has arisen in John and Liz's love affair. We take up the story when Phil meets Liz at a protest rally against the weapons manufacturer Lungless Labs. Here's part three of The Golden Gate, written and narrated by Vikram Seth.
Arrests occur. A speech is made.
Dawn rises over Lungless redly. The pioneers of the blockade are joined now by a motley medley. A marching carnival parade starts out from Lungless Park, cavorting along to Lungless Labs, supporting those who risk prison to defy the weaponry they all decry. Young couples, school children, grandmothers, old hippies, punks with hair dyed green, stage-suited men who've never seen another demonstration, others who've been to scores, walk hand in hand towards the place where death is planned. Those who devise these weapons, decent, adjusted, family-minded folk, don't think they plan death. Their most recent bomb, which, as an engaging joke, they dubbed the cookie cutter, batters live cells, and yet this is what matters. Leaves buildings and machines intact. This butchering brain spawns, now a fact. When something's technically attractive, you follow the conception through, that's all. What if you leave a slew of living dead, of radioactive collateral damage in its wake? It's just a job, for heaven's sake. Phil hears the crowd from where he's standing, engaged in a brisk conference with two TV reporters. Handing out pamphlets labeled Common Sense About Our Common Fate, Phil mentions briefly their plans and their intentions.
We'll have a speech by Father O'Hare. Then, in small groups, we'll walk out there and cross that line of demarcation while we block traffic going through. The cops will grab us two by two, that's standard for a demonstration, and haul us off to jail. In those yellow school buses, I suppose. As evidence of our sincerity, we won't resist.
The TV crew shoot several reels off with celerity, thank Phil, and turn to interview a Lungless Labs spokeswoman.
Really, these games cost the taxpayer dearly and have a minimal effect upon the labs. to misdirect attack upon an institution that serves the nations, a perverse, quixotic, petulant, or worse, an un-American resolution. As every president can attest, what we do here is for the best.
Liz! Liz!
Phil shouts.
This is fantastic! What are you doing here? And John? Where's he?
With an enthusiastic bear hug, Phil beams a smile down on Liz, who, one hand held down, restraining Charlemagne, whose great lung complaining has risen several decibels, and one hand on a sign that spells, "Cats and attorneys are disarming. Why aren't we all?" gasps out.
Oh, Phil, let go of... Charlemagne, keep still, don't... Ouch! That wasn't very charming. Look, you've drawn blood. I hope you're glad. Now, Charlemagne, don't make me mad. Perhaps I oughtn't to have brought him. He isn't used to the Malay. It's the jazz band that's overwrought him. But, Phil, as I was going to say, John isn't here. Did you expect him?
Well, no. It's just that I connect him.
Oh, thanks, Phil.
Liz smiles.
That isn't too astute or flattering of you. I, too, can... By the way, how's Eddie?
Eddie?
Asks Phil.
Oh, Ed. I see. I don't. Why are you asking me?
But now the microphones are ready. Father O'Hare says,
"Friends, a word."
And the brief parley is deferred. Now both blockaders and supporters are silent as the priest says,
"Friends, sisters and brothers, sons and daughters, the little time each of us spends. Can everyone at the back hear me? Yes? Excellent. And all those near me? Not too loud? Well, these few short years we spend pursuing our careers, our needs, our longings, our obsessions upon this earth, once gone, are dead. Of some who've spent their time, it's said they gathered manifold possessions. Of some, they broke their lives for wealth. Of some, their striving broke their health. Of some, it's said they learned to master the secret fusion of the sun. Of some, that they ran, rode, swam faster than till their advent man had done. Of some, they eked life out as drudges. Of some, but any life one judges, to praise, to blame, in peace, in strife, should strive to serve, not injure, life. Today we meet in celebration of life. Some have their children here, and all of us are of good cheer. Indeed, with our incarceration in those yellow school buses, we may find ourselves compelled to be as little children. Let's inquire with the same childishness as they. Should we not try to douse a fire that threatens to consume away not just our home, but the whole city? Or, with a worldly wise and witty shrug and rejoinder, should we turn the volume up and let Rome burn? We cannot wait for legislation. There is no shame in following Thoreau and Anthony and King, the old traditions of a nation that once, 200 years before, in its own birth, resisted law. Killing is dying. This equation carries no mystical import. It is the literal truth. Our nation has long believed war was a sport. Unoccupied, unbombed, undying, while over there the shells were flying, how could we know the Russian dread of war, the mountains of their dead? We reveled in acceleration at every level of the race. And even now we're face to face with mutual extermination. We talk as blithely as before of surgical strikes and limited war. To those who, with tall intellectual prudence, sniff at our brashness and state that our stance is ineffectual, that with our puny sling to stand against this latter-day Goliath is not wise, let me ask, how dieth the wise man? As the fool. To turn your face from horror will not earn you an indulgence. Help us fight it. 200 years ago, indeed, who would have dreamed slaves would be freed? That's one example, and I cite it to show how conscience, starting small, in God's good time, may conquer all.
In choreographed concatenation, the demonstrators quietly go across the line of demarcation and lay themselves down in a row. The traffic halts. They are arrested. With sharp civility requested to walk, and on refusal, dragged to the school buses, where they're tagged with plastic handcuffs. Once inside them, the ex-blockaders, unsubdued, revived by the bright yellow mood of their detention buses, ride them, singing, "Give peace a chance," locked tight in a slow transport of delight.
Coffee is drunk and Scrabble played.
Evening, Phil's house.
What's the detergent that's kept your soul unsoiled this time? You've always known the problem's urgent, but haven't knelt down in the grime to help your friends, Ed, by investing a few days of your life protesting. Do you imagine if you pray the megatons will wilt away?
No.
Well?
Well, Phil, it's the mentality. Us, them, the last thing that we need. That's the first thing these protests breed. Self-righteous superficiality won't extirpate the roots of sin or cure us of the mess we're in. But I don't mean to preach. The tension of the last week...
Ed says...
You know, I'm glad I'm not the first to mention prison, but, well, how did things go? Are you all right?
Oh, sure. They held us in circus tents, which served to weld us into coherent troops of clowns. I guess it had its ups and downs.
Why tents?
Phil laughs.
We were too numerous to fit in Lungless County Jail.
The food, Phil?
Neither cakes and ale, nor bread and tears.
Phil waxes humorous, while Ed grills him with serious mien on their 10 days of quarantine. As Phil talks on, his eyes grow radiant. Ed thinks of the first time they met. The weeks have warped the placid gradient on which his even wheels were set. Neither the sense at every meeting of his heart's full and rapid beating, nor the abrupt and scalding rush of redness to his face, the flush when he feels Phil's eyes resting on him, but something infinite and slow and tide-like holds his life in tow. The salt of human love upon him, to it his leeched will yields control, whether it stings or heals his soul. Ed's quiet for a while. Phil's quiet. Paul's off at the Lamont's today. The fridge hums, happy with its diet of ice cubes. Clocks click time away, contented with its circularity. Phil yawns. The crackling fissiparity of popcorn on the stove returns him to the present, and he burns his thumb endeavouring to extract it.
You okay? Let me help.
Ed gets butter and garlic salt and sets some napkins out. Now they've attacked it with starved abandon.
Whoa, it's hot. You're right, but really hits the spot. Do you like cooking, Phil?
Not really. Can't abide its cruelty.
Cruelty, Phil?
Right. You don't merely pop corns. You beat eggs, willfully stone cherries, whip cream, chop and skewer, are happier when cheese is bluer, and then there's batter, rack of lamb, and squash and mace ad nauseum. To printer's ink, let's get some coffee?
Yes, let's. I need a change of mood. And by the way, do they have food?
Sure. Brownies, muffins, fudge, cake, toffee. Most of the stuff's so good it hurts. And all supplied by Just Desserts.
Back home to sips of cherry herring.
Tastes like cough mixture.
Ventures Ed. Phil demonstrates his pluck and daring. Flamboyant sorties on the red, long words, impervious to Ed's challenge. All seven letters used in phalange. While Ed's words, wary, composite, short, closed, point-worthy, bit by bit chew up the board in ruthless nibbles, sealing Phil's options one by one. And when at last the game is done, and Phil, stuck with a beached Q, scribbles the final score, Ed smiles in glee at Phil, who smiles, but ruefully. Phil stretches, yawns, and stands up slowly.
Oh, well, guess it's time for bed.
Phil, tonight I only want to sleep.
Now, what's the matter, Ed? Don't you?
Well, I do, Phil, but...
But what?
It's just that...
It's Claire, then?
No, it's not. It's too hard to... Look, I can't explain.
Ed, don't play games with me again.
I love you, Phil. But my desire goes beyond sex. Lovers, indeed, must shed more than their clothes. They need to shed their bodies. Flesh and fire can meet, but can't merge. It's a state only our souls can consummate.
Phil stares.
You're sad, Phil. I can't bear it to see your eyes look so disturbed, as if, endeavoring to share it, I've let my heart run wild and curbed all your ebullience and elation.
Well, Ed, search out your own salvation.
Phil answers harshly.
Since your charm will keep you fairly safe from harm, and you've insured yourself in heaven, do me the courtesy to abstain from commentary on my pain. I'm off to bed. It's past 11. Sleep on the bed or on the floor, whichever boosts your godly score.
Phil.
Ed holds Philip's shoulder tightly.
Sit down. Don't go. Don't talk like that.
Like what?
Retorts Phil, his teeth whitely gnawing his lip.
You want more chat? More Bible bilge to get your rocks off? Well, I'm going to get my socks off. Don't fool yourself that I'm aggrieved. Ed, I'm a lot more bored than peeved. Good night, sweet prince. Say a Hail Mary for my benighted soul, but please keep your blood-curdling sympathies out of my ears. And now, good fairy, flit as you like with your limp wand. I'm sleepy, and I can't respond.
Ed, with a right hook, swift and vicious, knocks Phil down. Dazed, Phil makes a slow lunge for Ed, who, with adventitious timing, swerves straight into the blow. Phil grabs him by the throat, half-throttling him with the fury he's been bottling. Now Ed's on top, his jaw contused, and Phil's left eye and cheek are bruised. He tries to struggle, but Ed, younger and stronger, keeps him pinned. But now, quite suddenly, and God knows how, as if their unrequited hunger for blood's assuaged. The murderous peers start laughing through their angry tears.
Oh.
Ed feels his jaw, then, dazed and shaking, gets up. Phil views the mess around, books, Scrabble tiles. His eye is aching. Ed picks a bookend off the ground. Phil says,
"Don't bother, Ed. Just set it back on that shelf." No, I'll get it. Now sit down.
Phil, too, sits down and, murmuring,
"Ed, give me your hand,"
rests his left cheek against it, closing his eye that's pulsing black with pain.
"My fault, Ed. I won't yell again. Now, what was it you were proposing before our intermission?"
"Just that you don't treat me with disgust."
"Let me say something that will free you, whichever fork you choose. Love's whole, or else it's nothing. I can't see you, Ed, as this disembodied soul. I cannot fracture my emotions or twist delight to mystic notions. What I now feel, I won't hold back. What we once shared, I cannot hack in bleeding chunks out of my cortex. Give me your hand, Ed."
"God, it's cold." "I guess so."
Ed withdraws his hold and pulls back from the swiftening vortex in desperate strokes till he's on shore, trembling, but steadier than before. No more to say. They change, unsleeping. On the same bed they lie apart, what terrifying miles, each keeping unshared his bitterness of heart, the longing each feels for the other, their unburnt love. Perhaps another, who knows, attempt by Phil to touch his shivering friend, is it too much to ask of him, could still unite them. But obdurate now, he won't plead, demean his pride, reveal his need, 100 reasons why recite them. Ed falls asleep at last, but Phil, at 2, at 3, is wakeful still. Wakeful by the loved body, hours, hours to lie, untouched, apart, while memory's unpitying powers gouge out the past and lost thoughts start, shaming the will with their insistence against all counter of resistance. At dawn, Phil falls into a sleep that's as exhausted as it's deep. When he wakes, Ed has packed.
"That glowing black eye. What will you say to Paul?"
"Don't know. And you?"
"A drunken brawl. Phil, you'll discover easygoing refreshments soon, I know. It's I."
"Ed, close the subject."
"Right. Goodbye."
A quarrel is initiated.
Impervious to pleas and pity, to tender bribes and winning wiles, the stratagems of Psycho Kitty, Lamb, Catnip, Scratching Post, and Smiles, Charlemagne in his guts and sinews detests John still. And John continues to rave whenever wronged, and flail his arms around his head, assail his foe with missiles and invective, and mutter,
"It's that cat or me. Liz, Lizzie, darling, can't you see beyond that mentally defective, moth-eaten teddy bear to what a swollen cyst of spite he's got? You cat freaks are, quite simply, crazy. You'd weep more tears for one lost pet than for a flood in Sulawesi. It serves me right. That's what I get for thinking I had your affection. Well, next time, greater circumspection is what is called for."
"Stop it, John. When you go on and on and on, I love you, but I just can't stand you. I'm going out to buy some steak and bread and take a walk."
"Well, take your anti-nuclear cat to brand you with Agent Orange. That's a name more suited to his joyless frame.
Good plan. I think I will.
Liz leaves him to chafe alone against his wrongs. Suddenly, everything aggrieves him. Cat, house, work, Liz's tuneless songs, her tofu eating, kefir drinking, her...
Darling, what have you been thinking?
Quirks that delighted him at first, through the month's mill wheels, suffer worst of all the bills of love discounted, the bills and coups of dateless love. Alas, alas, as high above, to quote, as high as we have mounted, ah, Wordsworth, do we sink as low. And John finds it indeed is so. He mopes around, distraught, distracted, tries to read, can't, looks out. The sky, birdless, unclouded, blue, refracted through the day's smooth lens, strikes his eye. He sighs, gets up, puts on a sweater, an easier pair of shoes.
I'd better leave this apartment for a bit, or I'll...
But as he tries to fit the wrong key in the lock, a yellow Volkswagen halts and blares its horn with the wild will of the newborn.
For Christ's sakes, what's wrong with that fellow? Hey, stop that!
Oh, it's Phil.
Hey, hi.
Hi, John. Just thought I'd drop by. How are you? How's Liz? How's it going?
Okay, she's out and pretty good, I guess.
You guess?
Sure.
Well, you're showing signs of acute strain.
Phil, we should go for a walk. Look, don't be lazy. Staying in there will drive me crazy.
What's happened, John?
A lover's tiff. It's not worth mentioning.
Bullshit! If you keep on clenching and unclenching your fists like that, it's best to say what's on your mind. And anyway, I'm curious now.
I've had a drenching in the cold spring of truth.
What's that?
That more than me, Liz loves that cat.
John frowns.
I guess I never knew that a cat's designs could scupper mine. One lives and learns. Of course, it's true that everything still may work out fine. And so I sometimes think it's foolish to lay down terms. Why be so mulish when, given time... Yet, as Keane said, in the long run, we are all dead. It's not just that, though, Phil. My freedom to be alone, to watch football, and to eat junk food. These days, all I do is buy books. I can't read them. I'm dragged off to some dumb ballet, some feeble concert, or worse, play. It's not that we don't love each other. We're a good match. Liz dresses well. She's dynamite in bed. But, brother, her cerebellum's shot to hell.
Phil laughs as John goes on describing the bitterness he's been imbibing and offers sympathy, advice, encouragement, and all things nice that he can give without betraying his own beliefs. And by, John simmers down.
But Phil, your eye.
Oh, that. That's nothing. You were saying...
No, Phil, your left eye looks a bit contused.
It's odd you noticed it.
How did it...
Can you see it clearly?
Oh, no, it's very faint. But if you're at this angle...
So it's nearly...
What was it, Phil? A lover's tiff?
I guess so.
When?
Last week.
Fantastic. You've gone back to your orgiastic pre-Claire routine. Now, play-by-play and man-to-man, let's hear...
No way. It's private.
Nonsense.
John says, frowning.
You've grilled me. Come on. Fair is fair. Shake off that surreptitious air. Who did that to you? Quit the clowning.
Who do you think?
I must confess, I can't so much as start to guess. Someone I know?
Yes.
So I've seen her.
Not quite, but...
Sue?
No.
Rose?
No.
Jan?
You're on the wrong track.
Not Rowena.
No.
Phil, I give up.
Ed's the man.
Ed?
Yes.
You don't mean Ed?
Yes.
Jesus.
Don't gape at me. I'm not a rhesus monkey with AIDS.
Oh, Jesus, Phil. You mean that... It's not possible.
John stammers, shakes his head, then, shivering, emits a small bleat of disgust at this malformed and sickening lust, and turns away, while Philip, quivering, feels his fists clench and disengage in insult and astonished rage. As brother grimaces at brother when a dense veil of hate descends, they stare with loathing at each other, who just 2 minutes past were friends. instinctively together, turning back to the house, the car, discerning with instinct what the other feels. They walk in silence. John's head reels.
He was my roommate while at college. Thank God he didn't. I'd have knocked his head off.
Phil, enraged and shocked, thinks
John's a fool for all his knowledge. And what is worse, a cruel fool with the compassion of a mule.
They're at the door. John, hesitating, straining against himself to see past the revulsion, insulating him from all warmth and sympathy toward his friend, feels bound to utter,
"Well, come in."
Phil begins to mutter a brusque excuse, but with a grin, Liz, from a window, waves them in.
"Come in, you guys. I was just baking bran muffins. Good to see you, Phil."
She thinks,
"Do I detect a chill? Or is that the attorney making unwarranted deductions? No, it really looks as if it's so."
Inside, John mutters,
"Quite delicious."
Phil growls,
"Delicious. Gotta go."
Liz muses,
"More and more suspicious."
Phil rises,
"Getting late, you know."
Liz frowns,
"All right, but your permission to leave depends on one condition. Tell me what you two talked about. You looked so stern when I looked out."
John blanches,
"Nothing."
Liz laughs, taking his hand in hers.
"Now that's a lie. Well, Phil?"
"Oh, just that Ed and I had an affair."
But John, now quaking with anger barely in his rein, blurts before Liz can speak again,
"I'm going out. I just can't take this."
He stands.
"You've got your answer. Glad?"
Liz says,
John, for goodness sake, this isn't the way. It's not that bad. Look, Phil's your friend."
John shouts, dumbfounded,
"And Ed's your brother. I'm astounded that you can act so cool when he and Phil..."
He shudders helplessly.
"Anything goes in this damn city. Your brother's either sick or mad. And you know what? You're just as bad. And your gross cat. It's a real pity Ed hasn't seen a shrink. And you..."
He turns on Phil.
"Should see one too."
Phil gets up and walks out. Liz, dizzy with disbelief, sits still and stares. John looks at her.
"Oh, don't sulk, Lizzie. I didn't throw him out."
Liz glares.
"Well, don't you think that Phil's offended?"
"Liz, he offended you. It's splendid how you can blame me."
"What's the use? Christ! Sometimes, John, you're so obtuse!"
Liz stands up with abrupt decision. She's hoping, how she does not know, she can bring peace. That Phil, although no doubt concussed from the collision, can somehow still be mollified. His yellow car still parked outside. Head on the steering wheel, Phil's shaking. Liz walks outside and murmurs,
"Phil?"
He looks up, sees her.
"If you're making ambassadorial goodwill gestures for John..."
Liz says,
"I'm really here for myself, and I'm sincerely sorry, Phil. Look, unlock this door." "Thanks."
Liz gets in.
"I knew the score a month ago."
Now Phil's incredulous.
"That Ed?"
"That you and Ed."
"You knew? You mean Ed spilled the beans to you?"
"You did as well. Though fairly sedulous, Sunday before the equinox, you both wore the same mismatched socks."
Phil looks at Liz with awe.
"Amazing. We thought that we were so discreet."
"Forensic training."
Liz states, gazing out of the window at the street, where, near the curb, a few late flowers, survivors of pre-winter showers, clusters of lilies of the Nile, dark-foliaged, purple, reconcile the gazer to the hardening season. Liz says,
"The last days of the sun. We ought to savor them, each one. I wish we could... Well, there's no reason why we should not drive to the bay and take a walk. What do you say?"
Phil asks Liz how she came to be there that day at Lungless. Liz says,
"Well, those books you left inveigled me there. John didn't read them. I could tell you were surprised."
"I was. Belated congratulations. Your speech rated an A+. Meaty and concise."
"And how was prison?"
"Paradise. Like-minded souls in dense proximity. Juggling, hair braiding, foot massage. We did our own things, by and large, and worked plans out with equanimity. By, as they say, consensus, whence we formed the new verb, to consent."
They park the car by the marina. The surface of the Cobalt Bay is flecked with white. The moisture, keener October air has rinsed away the whispering mists with crisp intensity, and over the opaque immensity, a deliquescent wash of blue reveals the bridge, long lost to view in summer's quilt of fog. The towers, high-built, red-gold, with their long span, the most majestic spun by man, whose threads of steel through mists and showers, wind, spray, and the momentous roar of ocean storms link shore to shore. They climb the cliff to its approaches and start to walk across the bridge to the Marin shore, when Liz broaches, without the fluff of verbiage, the Ed affair. Phil shrugs a little. His eyes grow moist. His voice turns brittle.
I'll never understand him, Liz. I really don't know what it is. This past year has been... God knows I only want to... Well, God knows what. To live without this emptiness. To give a little love. Christ, I'm so lonely. He's got his thoughts, though. I've got mine. We're through, Liz. I don't mean to whine.
Liz sighs. And Phil murmurs,
I shouldn't be talking this way, least of all with you, Liz. I'm upset. I wouldn't have brought it up if...
With a small, a gentle nod of comprehension, Liz looks away while, with some tension, her own hand grips the low guardrails.
I think that...
And her voice now fails.
I think I understand the feeling.
Then, with an effort...
Well, love's fun at first. But living with someone you love can be less than appealing if everything's just great in bed, yet nothing's shared inside your head. But, Phil, we shouldn't be dissecting those whom we love behind their backs.
Oh, I don't know,
says Phil, reflecting.
I now yearn less for heart attacks, passion's angina, and love's blindness, than company and warmth and kindness. Perhaps I'm harder to disarm and cherish courage more than charm.
He looks at Liz.
I'm only speaking for myself, Liz.
Liz turns away and gazes out across the bay to where a band of smog lies, streaking the Oakland hills with a low haze. And as she speaks, her voice betrays her pain that she's almost betraying lover and brother.
Phil, don't say words that once said there's no unsaying. We should walk back. Who knows, things may get better. Anyway, it's Sunday. Let's cross the bridge. This is the one day of the whole week the Seaward View is open.
Phil smiles.
Saturday, too.
They cross. The westward arc of ocean beyond Point Lobos gleams with light. Phil lifts a hand to shield his sight, and Liz, with quiet and emotion, asks him how Paul is, and they talk with their old ease along their walk.
Vines rest in early winter light.
All the Doratis and their neighbors, whose scattered clans rejoin today, rest from their individual labors and go to church to nod or pray. They mill outside now the Thanksgiving service is over, now the living vines are asleep, and the repair of harvesting machines, the care of injured tractors, and the tending of the new crush for those whose crop ferments in fragrance drop on drop in their own cellars, mark the ending, a day of pious ritual cheer and gossip of the vineyard year. Back at the ranch, with two prospective sons-in-law wandering in train, Mrs. Durati, with reflective pauses to ease arthritic pain, walks slowly to the greystone winery, flame-red in its autumnal finery of Boston ivy, through the fields of straggling splendor, whose air yields the late rich musk of grapes decaying into the earth, leaves trampled down to humus, and the tattering brown vine bark, its darkened scars betraying the vine's sharp battles, won and lost each year with virus, pest, and frost. Impressed into the preparation of the great feast, the two house guests drift down a vapid conversation whose stream John suddenly arrests by asking Art, with a mock-hearty insouciance,
"Did Madame Durati by any chance, Art, question you about your plans regarding Sue?"
Art's knife halts its potato peeling. He looks at John and grins.
"I'll say. So she's begun on you today."
And in a flush of fellow feeling, the two compare notes and decide how many kids each must provide. 2 hours later, spent and bloated, like pythons who have swallowed pigs, all in the household are devoted to groaning gently after swigs and reminiscing to each other. Meanwhile, Sue's talking to her mother about the scholarship she's won to go to Paris.
"We've begun to think we should defer our wedding."
Mrs. Durati's face falls.
"Sue! Oh, dear! Oh, darling, not you too!"
And starts to cry. She fears she's heading towards a grandchildless last age, which no young spirit will assuage. Now it is midnight, and in keeping with long-standing Durati laws, each of the visitors is sleeping in his own upstairs room. Art's snores, conducted through the wall, are merging with John's dreams. Now a storm is surging. Now a slow sea beast snarls and grunts, and now a railway engine shunts. John sleeps through all this, and on waking, heads down for breakfast, where his host regales him over tea and toast with brief accounts of tartan making, the dusky-footed wood rat, and the history of the ampersand. Now Liz and John are slowly walking by the red water, hand in hand. Warmed by her memories, not talking, Liz slips into that early land, while John, whose hard-worked limbs are aching, senses a broad contentment taking him forward to the future.
"Liz, it strikes me that perhaps it is time we two should, well, be more serious. It's been a year since we first met. Your folks suggest we ought to get..."
He trails off with an unmysterious ellipsis and waits, confident of Liz's tremulous assent.
"Give me some time, John."
"Time? But surely we love each other well enough. Why are you acting so demurely?"
Liz says,
"There's more to life than love. I've got to think this out."
Still holding each other's hand, but with John scolding her gently, a bit puzzled, they walk homewards by a shorter way across the vineyard. As engaging as at the best of times he is, he turns to other things. But Liz discovers consternation raging within her heart and has no clue of what to say, feel, think, or do. Next day, by one of life's mischances, Mrs. Durati tries to broach the grandchild question. As she glances at Liz with unexpressed reproach, Liz shuts her book. Her mother, gazing mistily at her spouse, who's lazing, half-absent in his chair, first veers to married love, the ripening years, the boon of children, how she's yearning to see the same joy settle on their lives as well, then brings up John once more, and Liz, her earlobes burning, suddenly rises, and without comment or protest, walks straight out. The coda of this brief, upsetting duet for one voice is observed by Mike Durati, who, forgetting that peace is often better served not by alertness but by sleeping through all alarms, looks at his weeping wife and his daughter, who now stands, her book gripped tightly in her hands, immobile, in the dewy cover of new grass, quilting the long soil between the vines, while in a coil a red-winged hawk lists high above her. He sighs.
I'll talk to Liz, my dear. Don't be upset, love. You stay here.
He walks into the vineyard.
Lizzie.
He pats her hand. Her eyes are wet.
Come, Liz, don't get into a tizzy for nothing. I know you're upset about this, but you know your mother.
He kisses her.
Now, if your brother and sister shrugged it off, I'm sure you can as well, my dear. Now, you're the eldest and most understanding. Mum misses you a lot. This year you've hardly visited us here. Not that, my dear, I'm reprimanding, but you don't realize it can get lonely at times. Now, I just let the storm blow over. Liz, remember, your mother's aches and pains increase in winter, and it's late November. Now go in, darling, and make peace. And keep off things that could upset her. She's not got long. I mean, it's better if you go in and hold her hand.
Liz cuts in.
I don't understand. She's not got... what?
In sudden terror, she sees her father's face fall.
Dad!
Though silent, his unfeigning, sad eyes hold no hope, no hope of error. Dry-eyed with pain, at last Liz speaks.
When did...
We've known now for some weeks.
Elsewhere, John's thinking...
What a sunny morning this is. I feel today the world's at peace. I've got a funny feeling the tides have turned my way.
He muses breezily.
It's just as well that Lizzie didn't yield so easily. Anticipation's rather nice. This waiting adds a certain spice. Inaction's made me quite insightful. Let me...
And here he yawns.
Salute life, liberty, and the pursuit of laziness. It's quite delightful. Quite a thick letter here for Liz. I wonder who its author is.
The fuzzy postmarks, no assistance. There's no return address. John thinks...
That's odd.
And then a frigid distance, a disbelieving hatred sinks into his gaze as the handwriting nudges his memory, igniting cold glints of fury in his brain. He stands there, scoured with shock and pain. Liz enters. As she brushes past him to go into the living room, he grabs her shoulder.
I presume you plan to lead him on and cast him off with the same alacrity that he's dropped Claire, or you've dropped me? Well, I hope you enjoy each other.
Liz quietly says,
John, let me go. I must go in and see my mother.
John drops his arm. He cries out.
So, you don't deny this thing?
Liz staring at John, a desperate, despairing incomprehension in her glance, now slowly winds out of her trance.
What is it?
What? Oh, God, this letter.
Who's it from?
Phil.
What does it say?
With jealous loathing and dismay, John thrusts it in her hands.
You'd better find out for yourself. It's your mail.
Liz says.
John, I don't know what it is. Some anti-nuclear stuff, the trial.
Then open it.
Why?
Open it.
Not now.
So much for your denial.
Denial?
Don't give me that shit.
Liz cries.
I love you. Don't abuse me. John, I can't take it. Don't accuse me of having an affair with Phil. Don't drive me to it or I will.
And blinded by a fit of weeping, as if her heart were breaking, she makes for the door unsteadily. And when, a sick repentance seeping into John's heart, he tries to clutch her hand, she shudders at his touch. Mrs. Durati, driven thither by John's voice in fortissimo, turns from the doorway in a dither of indecision.
Mom, don't go!
Liz sobs and holds her mother tightly. Mrs. Durati, gently, lightly, passes her hand through Liz's hair, and Liz, in misery and despair, says,
Mom, Dad told me. I'm so sorry I ran away. I love you so. You should have told me.
Yes, I know.
I didn't want to cause you worry. I really don't believe it still. Sometimes I even hope it will just disappear as if by magic. But, Lizzie, I could live for years. So, darling, it's not quite as tragic as it originally appears. It's in the liver. It's not painful. It's these that...
And with a disdainful look at her knobbled hands, she smiles. Up in his room, John packs his files and clothes and thinks...
Thank God I vanished when she came in. I hate a scene.
Soon, grimacing, as if quinine had smeared his teeth, self-damned, self-banished, he starts his car. When Ed cries...
Wait!
John glares through him with transferred hate.
Here on RN Summer Features, we've been listening to Part 3 of The Golden Gate by Vikram Seth, adapted for radio by Julie Hudspeth. The narrator was Vikram Seth. John was played by Richard Clarkin, Janet, Jane Luke, Liz, Martha Burns, Ed, Michael Ripley, and Phil, Tony Munch. Original music was composed by Elena Katz-Chernan. The sound engineers were Philip Ullman, Drago Grandich, and Stuart Hall. The Golden Gate was directed and produced by me, Mike Ladd. Next week, in the final episode of The Golden Gate, there's a surprise wedding, the rekindling of an old affair, a death, a birth, and a tragic accident.
One Tuesday night, the cancellation of a performance frees the sheep to savour the unique sedation of soundlessness and early sleep. Jan turns her talents to creating sushi and sashimi. While waiting for John, her guinea pig, she sets the chopsticks out, regales her pets with scraps of herring, then, abstracted, turns to her sculpture, Mother Hen, chisels away at it, and when the doorbell buzzes in protracted protest, thinks,
Damn, who can that be? Oh, John, of course, how dumb of me.
She yells a cheerful,
I'm just coming!
Runs down the stairs, two at a time, hugs him, and with unconscious drumming, chisel on door, remarks,
John, I'm sorry. I'm in the very middle of... It's that hen. She's such a riddle. Go take a walk around the block and come back here at 8 o'clock.
John thinks,
She hasn't changed much, really, in all these years.
When he returns, they eat and talk, and John's heart burns with an old longing. Is it merely night or her unchanged waywardness? And he says,
Jan.
And she says,
Yes.
That's part 4 of The Golden Gate. And if you've missed any episodes or want to download your own copy, just visit the RN website and look for Summer Features. Tomorrow at 11, Ros Bluett continues a series of hindsight programs around the theme of hidden lives, with a rare and fascinating glimpse into what life was like for young women and girls who became nuns in the 1950s. That's Sister of Mercy, tomorrow on Summer Features.